Yo, what's good, what's good, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of the Isaiah Kid Podcast. We are back. So, I know a lot of people are going to be paying attention to March Madness. I know people are probably doing their brackets and so forth. But as I promised you guys, I said I was going to dedicate a separate episode just answering questions and comments that you guys have adequately left over the past couple of episodes. And I did it a little bit at the end of the previous episode, but this episode have basically most of the questions, most of the comments baked into the episode, so you guys can tap in and listen to that. And I can, you know, give you guys a response to the questions and comments that you guys have left. Everybody's going to do their brackets tomorrow. The tournament starts. This episode is going to actually drop Thursday morning. So, you know, give it a listen before you tune in and watch all the games all day, all throughout the weekend. I'm going to be doing the same myself, so I won't shame you. But first and foremost, I'm your humble and highly favorite host, Isaiah Kev, the Isaiah Kev Podcast. Shouts out to everyone that is listening. Shouts out to everyone that continues to support and listen to the pod, leave comments. Now, as I from time to time try to prompt you guys, please be sure to whatever DSP you're listening, whatever streaming platform that you guys are listening from, whether it is Apple or Spotify or another platform that that this podcast may exist on, subscribe or follow the pod. Follow it, give it a rating, leave comments. Like I said, I try my best to look at your comments, and you know, I'm gonna try my best to respond to as many as I can in this episode. Continue to do that for me. I greatly, greatly appreciate that. Kind of gives me a gauge of engagementship and so forth. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I greatly appreciate that. And if you just, you know, you just want to listen and, you know, listen from time to time, you don't have to comment. You don't have to do none of that. Just continue to listen, continue to support. I greatly take it in any form or fashion. Pause. But first, before I get to you, get to you guys' questions, before I do that, RG3 on, I guess it's his own podcast, he had made some comments, and they went pretty viral. And the reason why I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this is because I literally just got done talking about this very same topic. And basically, his comments that went viral over the past, you know, day or so is basically he stated that Caleb Williams should pull an Eli Manning and refuse to go to the Bears if they select him, right? And basically, his reasoning behind as to why he should pull an Eli Manning was because of the way they treated Justin Fields. Now, I totally, totally disagree with this statement. I think it's probably one of the dumbest takes I've heard. And I say that with all due respect to RG3. But I think it's one of the most least thought about. Like it is not very smart, right? It is not a great this take, and I get it. People say a lot of things, especially around draft time. You know, you get certain rankings, you get mock drafts, people make these hot and bold takes, you know, for clicks and whatever. And I'm not saying he's doing it for clicks, but this was pretty bad. This was a pretty bad take. So I'm gonna explain why. Now, I'll say this. This is where I give RG3 a little bit of bail. Here's where I'll give him a little bit of bail on just a smidge on this horrendous take of his. 99% of us, when we come up with these opinions and so forth, when we formulate the opinions in some shape or form, it may be based around some biases that we have, right? That, you know, we've experienced certain things throughout life and so forth. And I'll say this, even at 22, like, you know, you go through certain things, you learn, you live and you learn, right? And they say, you know, the old saying, like, you know, the best teacher is experience. And for instance, like, if someone is asking you, you may have played on a team, right? Or you may be a college student like myself. So you might have a professor, or even if you have like a job, right? And you have like a manager or supervisor, and someone just comes along and just asks you, you know, they have no, you know, they just don't have no knowledge of said person, but said person just comes around, they just ask you like, hey, how is coach so-and-so? How is professor so-and-so? How is your supervisor? You know, how are they? Like, how are they as people? How do they treat you, right? And that may come about, and you would give your particular answer, whether it's positive, it may be positive or negative, right? But for whatever reasons, regardless, you have a firsthand experience with, you know, maybe, you know, with that person, whether they were your coach or your supervisor or your professor, right? And there may be someone else that played on the same team as you, you know, or had the same class as you, or worked at the same company as you, and they may have a different perspective, and they may have a different opinion that you share about said supervisor, said coach, or said professor, right? That they may differ, but you have your own firsthand experience, and when someone asks you about that particular person, your bias may come in. It's gonna intertwine with the answer that you give them. So when it comes to go back to RG3, his experience with the Washington Redskins, now the Washington Commanders, I would say it changed his life. It changed his life big time. Now, I think in my heart of hearts, just my opinion, I think Robert Griffin thinks he got screwed in Washington. And I'm not going to debate whether or not he's right or wrong to think that or have that feeling. But I'm just saying, in my opinion, I think he got screwed. From the jump, I think from the Shanahan's throwing him out too quickly after his injury, or just from the jump, the Shanahan's just not wanting to draft him in the first place. And that's facts. That's no opinion. that's straight facts. That is no opinion. The owner, obviously, Daniel Snyder, he wanted RG3. The Shanahan's didn't want to make that trade up and get RG3. They didn't want RG3. They wanted their guy. They wanted the guy that they actually got in the fourth round, which was Kirk Cousins. So they, you know, regardless. But that's a fact, right? That's a fact. So sitting in RG3's shoes, right, and like from his perspective, you can kind of see how he can formulate such an opinion. Granted, I think it's a bit out there. I think it's a bit asinine. But you can see how his firsthand experience in a situation where he was drafted into a bad spot, and really a spot where the coaching staff didn't really want him, it hurt his career. It didn't help his career. It hurt him. So you can see, okay, like the advice, I would say, that RG3 is trying to give to Caleb, you can see why he's giving that advice, because he's dealt with a situation that didn't help his career. And it ultimately ruined his career. It didn't help. It didn't help him at all. But I think with that, he does come off a bit bitter. He comes off a little bitter. And like I said, if I was in his shoes if I was Robert Griffin III and I had dealt with that traumatic experience in Washington, And, you know, I go through the injury and so forth. And ultimately, the coach, offense coordinator, really didn't want to draft me in the first place. I understand the frustration. Now, to the Justin Fields part, did Justin Fields get a fair shot? I think, and I see it on Twitter, I see it with certain Bears fans, I think it is complete BS when people try to say, oh, Justin Fields didn't get a fair shot. Oh, he was dealt a bad hand. And, okay, like, yeah, like many young quarterbacks that get drafted high in the draft, right? If you get drafted high in the draft, more than likely, your team is usually bad, which makes it a very challenging proposition. I understand it. The first year, I understand it. Team wasn't great. I get it. I get it. Totally, totally understand it. But now, this past year, the Bears traded for DJ Moore, a high-end quality wide receiver one. They had Cole Kmet, a solid tight end. They improved the offensive line. They had a decent rushing attack, right? Right. He had enough around him in terms of offensive pieces to show if he was worth keeping around, and he didn't produce. And he did not produce. Justin has some amazing traits, and he's super talented. But in terms of processing information, scanning the whole field, it's still a work in progress. And the mental aspect of him playing the quarterback position, it just isn't there. And it's not up to par. It's not up to par. So when I see people say he didn't have a fair chance, he didn't have a fair shot, bullshit. Like, come on, we got to stop this. And granted, I will say this, the quarterback clock when you get drafted as a quarterback, especially high up, if you're drafted in the first, second round and teams throw you out there you're the future. You have a 2 year window, right? And I'm not saying that's the right way to properly evaluate and develop quarterbacks, right? Not every quarterback develop at the same rate, but that's essentially what it is. That's how it goes, right? So, and also get this. Justin Fields, when you get, this goes for pretty much any job in this country. When there's new management or a new supervisor, new boss, just based off the fact that they hold no interest. Ryan Poles got hired as a GM. He didn't draft Justin Fields. He didn't draft Justin Fields, right? That's not his guy. So anytime there's new management, there's a new boss in town, your job is automatically in jeopardy because they have no interest to you. So that goes for pretty much any job, right? When there's a new boss, when there's new management, I mean, people can cut bait. Anybody can be on the chopping board, right? So that's just that. Now, on to the Caleb Williams portion. He should not pull Eli Manning. And the mere fact that Robert Griffin said that is just insane to me. It's just insane to me. And it's crazy because literally the previous episode, I talked about the offensive supporting cast that this Bears team is going to have for potentially number one pick Caleb Williams. It's pretty insane. It's pretty insane. So, like, literally the only piece that's missing to this Bears offensive group is a quarterback. Everything else is pretty set. Improvement on the offensive line, right? They got DeAndre Swift at the running back position. Like I said, I think they overpaid a little bit. I think they slightly overpaid him, but he's a decent player, right? And then obviously the passing options, the pass catchers that the Bears have, they're really good. I mean, they ain't too many number one teams. They ain't too many teams that pick, period. Not just teams with number one pick. There ain't too many teams with a Keenan Allen and a DJ Moore at wide receiver one and two. Not too many teams have that type of situation at the receiver spot, right? But since I've been living, I took it a step further. Since I've been living, you know, this has to be one of, or if not, the best situation that a number one pick has ever walked in, that has ever walked into. I mean, just given what's around offensively, you taking apart, I talk about the offense, but defensively as well. I mean, this is one of the best situations that a number one pick, since I've been living, that a number one pick has just got drafted to and walked into. And honestly, I think we're taking for granted how set up this situation is for in Chicago. It is abnormal for a team with the number one pick to be in this particular situation. It's abnormal. It's not, it usually does not work out like this, right? It does not work out like this. If you even, not even number one pick, but if you're picking within like the top five, more times than not, your team sucks. Your team is not good. There's holes everywhere. There's holes everywhere. So this is pretty normal. I.e., ask Bryce Young. I don't care where you stand on the Bryce Young. Like, if you're a Bryce Young fan or you're not if you're not a fan of Bryce Young, I don't care what side of the table that you sit on. But it was pretty obvious that he was going to have a rough time, and it's kind of hard to evaluate him because the Panthers were so goddamn bad. They were so bad. They were so shitty. So it does not matter. I look back at Jared Goff's goodness gracious. Jeff Fisher was on the hot seat. He didn't even make it the entire season. I'm old enough to remember when after Jared Goff's rookie year, people were calling him a bust. I'm old enough to remember that. People were calling him a bust, and they were like, man, this dude can't play. Come on. Right? Like, so when typically, right, teams with the number one overall pick, the teams are bad. And usually the number one pick, the player that was chosen with the number one pick, he's usually probably the best player on the team, if I'm being honest. He's probably the best player on the team. So we're aware of the personnel that they have. But even in this draft, granted, they have the number one pick, but they also have the 9th overall pick. So they have two picks within the top 10. So on top of potentially drafting Caleb Williams, right, presuming that they probably will, right, I'm thinking in that mindset, they also have the benefit of having the 9th pick. So that means they're going to be able to draft another high-end prospect to fill in this roster and complete it, to add to this team. And I would say, honestly, the one question mark that I have is probably the head coach, Matt Eberflus, right? Matt Eberflus, I think he's a good guy, good personality. But is he a good coach? We don't know, right? We don't know. And if he doesn't work out, I trust and believe me, I mean, if he doesn't work out, and if the Bears do decide to move on, this will be a very desirable head coaching job. If Matt Eberflus, if it turns out that he's not a good coach or whatever. But that's the one question mark. That's the one thing that's kind of like, that we still haven't answered. But you look at the personnel, offensively, defensively, this team is good. this should be a pretty good team. This should be a pretty good team. We just got to see if the coach is solid or not. So I think it's a bad idea. I think it's bad for business if Caleb Williams was to do such a thing, if he was to pull a Eli Manning. I just hate the idea of that too. I hate the idea of the number, like that's the whole point of the number one pick in sports. When you are the top pick in any sport, more than likely you are probably going to one of, if not the worst team in the sport. But if you're worthy of the number one pick, that is why you're the number one pick. I never understood that. I've never understood it. I've never understood that concept. I get it. Where you land matter. But if you're the top pick, you're the top pick, damn it. Like, get over it. But this is a really good idea. This is a really good situation. This isn't like, this situation is abnormally good for a team that has number one pick. Okay, let's shift gears to answering some questions, right? I was supposed to answer some questions and comments, but I had to talk about that RG3, that his take was just that bad. I mean, I had to. So, but let's get to it. I didn't pick out like literally every question and comment, but I picked out a good few, good variety. I'm gonna give out some answers or whatever, give you guys my insight. But thank you guys for putting up these questions and asking them and so forth. Okay, let's go. The first question on the list is, can Oregon come in year one and win the Big Ten? Now, I think so. Can they? Yes. I think they definitely can. And as you guys know, I'm really high on Oregon. I really like Dan Lanning. I like what he's doing. I think out of all of the Pac-12 teams that is now joining the Big Ten, I think they are the most equipped, and they will quickly adapt to the Big Ten because in some ways they already recruit and play like a Big Ten football team. So I don't think, I mean, granted, there'd be some adjustment, but I think their adjustment isn't going to be as drastically different or as drastic, I should say, as some of the other schools that are joined, like some of the other Pac-12 schools that's joining the Big Ten. Now, Oregon, you say, let's just say, because I'm really high on Oregon, but let's just look at their roster and just raw data. If you look at their roster and raw data, and I have a couple of things or like a checklist where I think you need these things in order to win the Big Ten, right? Especially with conference realignment and conference is just so stacked. First, I think you need high level / consistent quarterback play, right? I think you need really good to elite offensive line and defensive line play. I think that is definitely a must. You have to have the players and the dudes up front on offense and defense in order to compete at the highest level in the Big Ten. I think your defense has to be somewhat solid, right? I don't think you can just walk in and have a bottom feeder defense and think you're going to win the Big Ten. So I think your defense has to be at least above average, at least, right? And then coaching matters. Your coaching staff matters. So granted, it helps when you got the Jimmys and the Joes, but it also helps when you have a guy that can dial up the X's and the O's as well. So it helps. And with Oregon, I mean, let's just go through the checklist. They have Dylan Gabriel. They're bringing him in. He's had 30 touchdowns, 6 interceptions last year at Oklahoma, including 12 rushing touchdowns. So we're getting 42 total touchdowns with 6 interceptions. You mix that in with Oregon's already offensive nucleus and Will Stein, one of the best offensive coordinators in the country, I think you can check the box of high level to consistent quarterback play. I think they get that. Offensive line, defensive line, or well, the second thing is really good offensive line to elite, really good to elite offensive defensive line play. I think Oregon checks that box as well. They bring back both tackles. I think they're going to be good at center, and with the interior offensive line, they've been able to address that in the portal over the past several years. So I think their offensive line should be very well solid. With their D-line, I think the same here. They have recruited at a really, really high level in terms of their defensive line play. They have recruited their asses off in that department. And they portal well in that department as well. They bring in a lot of versatility, a lot of depth. So, and also to, you know, fillify that defense, because a lot of what's not coming back, they're missing a lot of guys in that secondary. Well, they grabbed 2 4 stars to fill out that secondary. So I think you can check the box on really good to elite offense and defensive line play, and then, you know, solid defense. I think they have. And then coaching. I think Dan Lanning is one of the best in the business in terms of a young head coach. And I know people are going to be like, well, he hasn't won anything. And, you know, he's only been on the job for an hour. So he's going into year three. But I think Oregon can win the Big Ten. I think they're very capable of winning the Big Ten in their first year. And if you don't believe they can, I mean, they have the 4th best odds to win a national championship, right? Georgia, Texas, Ohio State, and then Oregon. Like, those are the odds. Not in that order. I think in that order, I think it's Ohio State, Georgia, Texas, Oregon. In that order. Those are the 4 best odds to win a national championship. So Vegas is telling you this team is a national championship caliber team. So yes, I think they can win the Big Ten in their first year. Let's go on to the next question. Next question. Okay. This is a pretty good one too. Before the draft, Isaiah, who's some teams that you feel like are stuck and what should they do? So I'm assuming when you mean stuck, you mean like they're in the middle tier, right? They're not like horrendously bad and it's obvious what they need to do, but they're not like Super Bowl contenders as well. And I think I have the perfect answer for this question. It's the Saints. The Saints are the epitome of mid in the NFL. Right. I think they are the poster child in terms of mediocrity in the NFL. I think they are as mid as they come. They are what we call in no man's land. You know how in the NBA, the worst position as a team you can be in the NBA, the worst position you could be in is as an organization. Is a team that you're good enough to make the playoffs as like a 6th, 7th, 8th seed, maybe good enough to make the playoffs, but you have no goddamn shot at winning a series, but you're also not bad enough to miss the playoffs and suck in order to get a lottery pick. So you know what you got to do? You know what you do? You continue to make the playoffs year in, year out, but you continue to get bounced in the first round. And that right there, that is the epitome. This is like the version. This is that version in the NFL. The Saints are that version. I mean, and it comes to a point where I don't understand the direction that they're going in, right? Like, I just don't understand which way they're going in. And they're trying to convince their fan base that, you know, the coach and quarterback duo of Derek Carr and Dennis Allen is a contending duo. I think otherwise, right? I think otherwise. In a year in the NFC where it was relatively, I would say, weak when you're comparing it against the AFC, the Saints couldn't even win their own division. And they were supposed to be locks, right? And I think a lot of this stems from New Orleans first, they're in salary cap hell. And for years, in the back end of Drew Brees' career, they were trying to make Super Bowl push after Super Bowl push after Super Bowl push. And then once Drew Brees retired, they just continued to have this same thought process as, we're going to continue to try to be this contender. Granted, we no longer have Drew Brees. Secondly, Drew Brees, his last year and a half was kind of hard to watch, right? But they all convinced, they tried to convince us that they were a Super Bowl quality team. And it's only just carried over and continued over into the Derek Carr and Dennis Allen era. If you don't believe me, this team, clearly this organization thinks they're still contending. I argue that they're not. And I think a lot of people would argue the same. Here it is. They're still trying to contend because they restructured Derek Carr's deal. So instead of him having a big cap hit this year, his cap hit is only $12 million. But if you look at the next 2 years, his cap hit goes from $51 million to $61 million. Like astronomical numbers. Astronomical numbers. And then as a whole team in general, and as a whole team, they'll be over the cap over the next 2 years. Next year, they'll be $60 million over the cap. And the following year, they'll be $70 million over the cap. That's league high. That's the highest in the league. And these are all projections. But that'll be the highest in the league, right? And it's not like they have a bad roster. They have decent players, decent talent on their roster. But overall, the direction of the Saints, it just feels misguided and, uninspiring. It doesn't give – like, if you're really a true Saints fan in this fan base, it can't be that inspiring. It's very much uninspiring. And then the funny thing is, they are mediocre, but they're spending $300 million on this mediocre roster that is also a league high. That's the most in the league. So something isn't adding up. And I think, like I said, the problems here, they're stuck with Derek Carr and that contract. They're stuck with that. So I don't know how that's going to age, but they're stuck with it. Dennis Allen, really good defensive coordinator, but he's the classic good coordinator, not a great coach. And then you look at the financial crisis that they face. I mean, they have been in salary cap hell for over the past like 2-3 years. And it's only going to continue for the next 2-3 years. I mean, so I don't know what they do because, like I said, they're tied in financially to Derek Carr. I mean, they could move off of Dennis Allen if it does not pan out this year. But this team is in a ray. And I'm not saying they're a bad team. That's the whole point. They're not even a bad team. They don't stink. They're just not a contender. But they're built and their salary cap situation makes it seem like they're contending, but they're not. I think at best, this Saints team will probably be a 9-8 team. They're a 9-win, 8-win kind of team. And, this offseason, they signed Chase Young to a fully guaranteed deal. Chase Young I don't think he's the guy that the Commanders drafted years ago. Right? I don't think he's that guy that they drafted so high in the draft. I don't think he's that guy. So we'll see what happens with the Saints. But to answer your question, what team feels like they're stuck? My answer has to be the Saints. And it's been the Saints for a couple of years now where it just seems like they're in quicksand and the easiest way to get good in the NFL is to stink, right? Like, that's the easiest way to get good. And with the Saints, that's the funny part. They don't stink, but I think they're subjectively in a worse spot than some teams like that have not been good. But the Saints, and the conference is getting better. The conference around them is getting better. The NFC South, their own division, got better, right? the NFC West, the nine, look at the Niners, look at the Rams. They're not going anywhere, right? Seahawks, they're well run. They're not going anywhere. You look at the NFC North. NFC North, scary. I mean, you got Detroit, you got Green Bay, Chicago has some really good upside. And then you got out in the NFC East, you got Dallas, who, you know, I mean, you say what you want, but they're good for 11 to 12 wins. And then Philly. Philly's well ran. They'll be in a mix of things, and then we'll see what happens with the Commanders and the Giants. But the conference is even getting better. And I thought last year was a perfect opportunity for the Saints to win a division, get a home playoff game, right? They couldn't even do that in a inferior conference. So that's how I feel about the Saints. I think they're stuck. How does Coach Deion and Colorado fare in the Big 12 this year? I'm going to say this. The Big 12, if someone was asking me, pick a team to win the Big 12 this year, like right now, I would probably lean with Utah, given with the, you know, they arguably have the best coach in the conference in Kyle Whittingham, right? They're a really good developmental program as a whole. They get Cam Rising back off of injury. I would probably lean with Utah if someone was asking me to just pick one team. But if you look at the odds to win the conference, it's all jumbled up. And essentially, Vegas is telling you it's a pick 'em. It's a pick 'em in the conference. And I think that, you know, the Big 12, they won't have the high-end elite premium teams that the SEC or that the Big Ten might have. But in terms of just drama and chaos, I certainly think it will be a lot of that in the Big 12 this year. Because I think none of the teams in the Big 12 are like big time recruiting powerhouses. A lot of the programs in the Big 12, they're really good developmental programs, bringing players along and developing them. That's what the conference is made out of. And the conference also has some really good coaching. As I mentioned, Kyle Whittingham, Lance Leipold, right? There is some really high-end coaching in that conference. So in terms of Colorado and how they fare and Coach Prime, I think they fare well. Now, I say I think they fare well because if they really have fixed their issues in terms of the offensive line and the defensive line play, so being able to protect their quarterback and being able to stop the run, being able to generate pressure, if those issues are patched up and they are truly resolved, I see no why Shedeur Sanders can't have a really good year. I see no reason why Colorado offensively won't be, like, they can't be productive. So I think with that, and assuming that is the case, they could do very well in the Big 12, I think, right? I'm not going to make some bold take and say they're going to win the Big 12, but I think they could fare well. There isn't much separation from the best team in the conference, which might be Utah, from the fifth and sixth best team in the conference, right? Whoever that may be. I think the conference is going to be close. It's going to be a close, tight race. So the gap, like, you know how the gap between Georgia and the 12th best team in the SEC is, it's wide, right? It's wide. If Georgia played Vanderbilt 10 times, Georgia'd probably win 10 out of 10 times. The gap between Utah or whoever you think the best Big 12 team is, and let's just say for argument's sake, it's Utah, and whoever you think the sixth or seventh best Big 12 team, the gap isn't that wide. I don't think the gap is that wide. And the odds show it. The Vegas odds show it. So I think they fare well. All right, so next question. Got my guy Ryan. He says, seems like the pod is getting better and better. But Isaiah, can you explain why fans and certain media members call certain college football coaches or programs overrated? I can definitely explain. Now, and thank you. I will say this. We live in a society where, first, you're either good or you're trash, right? You're either great or you're trash. If you're not great, then you're trash, right? I don't know where that comes from, but that's just how some people operate. That's how some people operate in society in terms of sports. You're either great or you're trash, right? And then we also have ring culture, where there's the casual fans out there. And it kind of stems from like the NBA, you know, comparing players and so forth, the GOAT talk. Everybody just like to talk about championships and rings and rings. And yes, championships matter, but it's become overstated. And when you talk about guys like Brian Kelly, and I've witnessed it. You talk about guys like Brian Kelly, you talk about guys like Ryan Day, James Franklin. People like, well, I mean, you say like they're really good coaches. People be like, well, what have they won? They haven't won anything. They haven't won a national championship. But people will ask you, what have they done? What have they won? What makes them really good? And I'm like, okay, first, there's only three active head coaches in college football that's won a national championship. Kirby being one of them, Kirby Smart, Dabo Sweeney being another, and Mack Brown being the other guy, the last guy, the third guy. Outside of that, no other active college football coach has a national championship. So when people are saying, well, what have they won? It is completely outrageous, and it's corny. Dare I say it's corny. I do not understand this crowd. Like with Brian Kelly, you can sit up here and say Brian Kelly is a top five coach in college football, right? Right. You can say that. And then someone would be like, well, he hasn't won a national championship. What has he won? Well, God damn it. There's only been three coaches. That's only three active coaches that's won a national championship. And one of the coaches in Mack Brown, you don't believe that he's a top five, top 10 coach right now in college football. You don't. And that's okay. No, shout out to Mack Brown. He's an all-time, he's a living legend. But you don't think right now, currently, that he is a top five coach in college football. So, yes, I think Brian, and I'm just using Brian Kelly as an example. And soon I will rank, you know, the best college football coaches in the country. But Brian Kelly, I can just already tell, I don't know where he would rank, but he's going to be somewhere top of the list. He's not going to be at the top, but he's going to be in that 4-5-6 range. He's going to be in that 4-5-6 range. So I don't understand when people say that. Well, what has he won? Well, guess what? Notre Dame, you want to know who's the winniest coach? Who's the winniest coach in Notre Dame history? Yes, Brian Kelly. Brian Kelly is the winniest coach in Notre Dame history. So, like, that includes Lou Holtz. That includes everybody. He's the winniest coach in that program's history, in that storied program history, right? Right? Like, it blows me. And then when people say, oh, well, Brian Kelly is overrated and Ryan Day is overrated and Lincoln Riley is overrated. I'm like, you want to know? I love when people say such and such is overrated. I love it. I love it because usually, I mean, I'm going to give you guys a hint. Usually, the person that people say is overrated, they're not overrated. They're not. But here's the question I always hit with people when they say, oh, he's overrated. Well, simple question. What is he rated? What is he rated? People always say Brian Kelly is overrated or this one is overrated. Ryan Day is overrated. I don't think no one has ever said Brian Kelly was the best college football coach in America. No one says that. No one says that. No one says that. Right? No one says that. But just because, oh, you don't have a national championship, the dodo bird over there tell you that just because he'll have a national championship, he's not a good coach. Right? Kyle, also, if you want to use that same logic, Kyle Whittingham hasn't won anything, you know, just hasn't won anything. Doesn't have a national championship. Who cares, right? That'll be people's take. But Kyle Whittingham is as consistent as a coach that we have currently in college football, right? He is one of the best. I'm old enough to remember when people used to say these same things about Jim Harbaugh. Well, what has he won? He don't have a national championship. He can't beat Ohio State. He can't do this. He can't do that. And that's the thing. A lot of these coaches that you guys say can't do this and haven't won a national championship and they're overrated. These coaches that you talk about, you know, you the Brian Kellys, the Ryan Days, the Steve Sarkisians, the Dan Lannings. It's not the fact that they can't. It's just that they haven't yet. They just haven't done it yet. I remember people used to say the same thing about Kirby Smart. Can't win the big one. He can't win national championship. Even at Georgia, can't win national championship. People used to say the same thing about Kirby Smart. I swear. I'm old enough to remember people used to say the same thing about Jim Harbaugh. People used to say the same thing about Kirby Smart. It wasn't that they can't or they couldn't win a national championships. It's just that they haven't yet. And when we talk like that, it's just reckless. Harbaugh, he can't beat Urban Meyer. Well, last time I checked, Urban Meyer had a 90% win percentage. He had a 90 win percentage at Ohio State. Tell me who else. Just rattle off the names of coaches that was beating Urban Meyer at Ohio State, because there weren't many. There weren't too many that were beating him consistently. Not too many of them. Right? Right. Right. Not too many of them. And I had to defend Harbaugh for years. I had to defend Harbaugh for years. I had to go to the sword. I had to swear by it. And I have to do the same thing with Ryan Day. Oh, he can't beat Michigan. He can't win a big one. Okay. Okay. All right. Or when people say such and such is overrated. But what is he rated? I think in terms of programs, to answer your second part of the question, in terms of programs, the two programs that come to mind that I hear the most, like overrated talk is Penn State and Notre Dame. And with Notre Dame, I know why people nitpick and call them overrated. I don't think it's valid, but I know why people do it. It's because of the brand, right? The Notre Dame brand. It's because people don't like the fact that they got the NBC affiliation. You know, they're still independent. Mind you, back in the 80s, there were a plethora of schools that were independent, right? Notre Dame just stayed independent as other schools in programs joint conferences, right? But it was once not such a, it wasn't so touche, right? It wasn't so peculiar that that a team was independent. It was actually regular. It was a norm, it wasn't so abnormal. So that's why people, you know, and honestly, they haven't won a national championship since the 80s. They haven't won a national championship. So people feel like, oh, why do they still get talked about? Why do they receive so much attention? What have they done? They're overrated. And I'm like, goodness gracious. Like, y'all, 6 out of the last 7 years, Notre Dame has won 10-plus games. They've won 10-plus games 6 out of the last 7 years. No one, and they're not overrated. Because guess what? I don't hear people saying Notre Dame is better than Georgia or Alabama or Texas or Ohio State. No one says that. No one says that. No one on this, no one that covers college football and actually watch college football, no one says that. No one says that. All of those schools I just named, no one calls Notre Dame better than them. No one says Notre Dame is better than those particular schools. No one says that. And you know why? Because it's true. They're not better, right? They're not better. Those schools like Texas, Ohio State, Alabama, Georgia, Ohio State, they're recruiting at a different level. And at this point, they're getting better caliber players than Notre Dame. But Notre Dame is right in the tier below, right? It's nothing against Notre Dame, but they're right in the tier below. And then for Penn State, I just don't understand that. I just don't understand the James Franklin and Penn State hate. Granted, their offense was really anemic last year, and I hope it gets better. But in terms of the overrated talk, I don't understand, because they're not, I don't feel like they're overrated. I feel like Penn State is the most perfectly rated team in the country. They're one of the most perfectly rated teams in the country. Because guess what? No one says they're better than Michigan, and no one says they're better than Ohio State. Because guess what? They can't beat those teams consistently, and they haven't beaten those teams consistently. So no one calls them better than that. But when you say, oh, they're not good or they're overrated, it's like, yeah, if the 12-team playoff, hell, if the 8-team playoff existed, if playoff expansion existed for years now, you guys realize that Penn State would have had several playoff appearances, right? With the new 12-team playoff format, Penn State would have had several, not just a couple, not just a, they would have several playoff appearances. So when people make this whole big hoopah about Penn State being overrated, I think it is complete, utter foolishness and bullshit. I think it's crazy. I think it's blasphemy to even say that. I don't think they're overrated. No one says Penn State is better than Ohio State. No one calls Penn State the best team in the Big Ten. No one says that. Oh, no one says that. You know what happens? People just run with these takes, run with narratives. Oh, they haven't won anything. They can't beat Ohio State. Yeah, duh. That's why Ohio State's rated and ranked above them. That crazy tangent. Next comment or question. Hey Isaiah, don't know if you've talked about it a bunch, but have you watched the Patriots Dynasty doc, and what are your thoughts? So yes, indeed, I have watched the Patriots Dynasty documentary. It's on Apple TV. It's like 10 parts to it, 10 episodes, whatever. And overall, I mean, it was pretty cool insight to see and, you know, get most of the stuff I kind of already knew, right? You know the outcome. Most of the stuff I already knew, but there was some, like, you know, little intricate minor details that I learned while watching the doc and so forth. I would say in terms of my thoughts, and this has kind of been brought to my attention, and I've been asking a couple people that I know, have you seen this documentary? How you feel about it? Just me personally, I think it is very pro-Brady, pro-Tom Brady, and pro-Robert Kraft, and very anti-Bill Belichick. The way how the documentary, it portrays Bill Belichick, you will think he is this old grumpy grandpa. And, I mean, to some people, he is. He does have this reputation of being kind of grumpy and serious and kind of stale. He's really militant. He comes from a military background. He's old school, right? He's old school. So some of that reputation and some of those stereotypes that Belichick get, I think first, I think most of it is true, but I think they also, the documentary could have did a better job at highlighting the brilliance and the expertise and the genius of Bill Belichick and how he made everything kind of go, or how he started to get everything going in the right direction. Like I said, Tom, I think it's really pro Tom Brady and pro Robert Kraft. Like I said, no disrespect to those guys, because those guys played their respective part. And Brady, I mean, he's proven that, like, it wasn't just Belichick, right? Brady had a lot to do with it. And the players love Brady. His teammates loved him. But in terms of how the doc and how it paints and illustrates Bill Belichick, I do think it's definitely not in the best light. And for instance, I just stumbled across a Rodney Harrison and Devin McCourty interview, and basically they talked about, you know, they talked about the reaction to the documentary, and they kind of felt like they were led astray. You guys can go find that video, but they kind of felt like they were led astray because I'm assuming that the producers, you know, had questions, and they interviewed these guys for hours and hours at a time. And Rodney Harrison and Devin McCourty was like, it didn't seem like the documentary and what their input in the stories that they have told, it didn't seem like that stuff was incorporated. It didn't seem like that stuff was incorporated and ingrained into the doc, right? So overall, if I'm being honest, the documentary was really, really negative. For a team that won a lot, for the NFL's greatest dynasty, it definitely was very dark and negative, I would say. But go check it out. Go check it out for yourself. But that's just my thoughts. Okay, next question. Who are some of your biggest winners in free agency? All right, so I like this question too. That's why I picked it out. I think there's a couple of misconceptions about free agency in the NFL. I think one of the big misconceptions is, first, like, not the elite players in this league typically don't hit free agency, right? So, like, the Micah Parsons, the Myles Garretts, right? The Jamar Chases, the Justin Jeffersons, those type of guys don't hit the free agency market. Right, those, it's very rare, you see it very seldomly that those type of caliber of players are just on the open market to be bought. Highly, highly unlikely. The best players typically in the free agency market in the NFL, they're usually like B to B minus players. Not bad players, right? But they're usually like B players. They're usually B players. So that's like a misconception where, like, free agency, you know, teams is buy. No. The best players are usually like B guys, right? Because the elite guys, their teams are not just letting them walk. They're gonna either get a long term deal, some type of deal, or they just get franchise tag. The second misconception is, you know, free agency is just, you can solve all your problems in free agency and you'll be all set and ready and dandy to go to the Super Bowl. That's another misconception. NFL free agency, it's a 33% hit rate. So some of these moves that we may deem that, you know, it makes sense, quote unquote, and that we may like, some of these moves, you know, mid-October going into November, we're going to look at some of these movies like, what the hell were they thinking? Why in the hell did they sign this guy? Watch. It always happens. It always happens like that. So NFL free agency is a 33% hit rate. And so there's some hits. It's really hit or miss. And honestly, there's more misses than actual hits, right? So that, like, it's not guaranteed at all that half of these free agents will work out. Statistically, historically, more than half of these free agency signings won't work out in some form or fashion. They just won't work out, whether it's due to injury or player get cut or whatever. Player's just not good, don't fit the scheme, whatever. It's just history shows itself that it's probably not going to work. So those are just some misconceptions. In terms of biggest winners, because the misconception is going to help my answer, I don't really necessarily have a biggest winner. Me personally, I like what the Texans have done. I've liked what the Jets have done in free agency. I feel like whatever team, there was another team. The Commanders, they made some solid moves. The Bears had a really good offseason, I feel like, so far. But for instance, the Bears, they paid DeAndre Swift about $8 million. I thought that was a little bit of an overpay. $8 million for DeAndre Swift. He's a decent player, a solid player, but, you know, that was a bit of an overpay. And that's what typically happens in free agency. I remember last year, Mike McGlinchey, offensive guard, played for the 49ers, became a free agent. The 49ers let him walk. Because guess what? Mike McGlinchey, he's a good run-blocking guard, but he can't pass protect. But on the open market, Mike McGlinchey, he got $55 million from the Broncos. $55 million. $55 million on the open market from the Broncos. And I always say, you're only worth what someone is willing to pay you. Yes, that's true. That is very true. And if the Broncos didn't give him that money, another team would have been close to that dollar amount. So the Broncos had to outbid. And that's the thing. You find yourself happening to outbid with other teams, and you end up paying a little bit of a steeper price than what you intended for and than what you should be paying. Because Mike McGlinchey, like I said, solid offensive guard, but he isn't, like, he's not Lane Johnson, right? He's not Zach Martin. He's not that caliber of player. He's pretty good, but the Broncos had to pay him $55 million. That, like, at the end of it, they're going to probably look back. They're going to be like, that's a shitty deal. That was a shitty deal because he's a good run blocker, can't pass protect. So that's ultimately what can happen, and it happens a lot in free agency where you're bidding with other teams. You're trying to outbid. You get the guy, and it's like, well, you spent this amount of money on him for X amount of money, but he's not even a top three, top four, top five player at the position. And that's what it ends up. And then I think DeAndre Swift, it's not as crazy as the Mike McGlinchey contract, but it just goes to show you how it can happen. It just happens. So, like I said, I don't have the biggest winners. I can't say someone like just took over free agency and just knocked it out of the park. But there were some teams, there were some moves that I liked from certain teams. Another comment, the Jets been patching up some of their weaknesses. How do you feel about their free agency signings? So I kind of answered this question a little bit. I like the signings. Now, as I told you guys, free agency, NFL free agency, 33% hit rate. And you look at the Jets and, you know, the acquisitions that they have made, not just in free agency, but, you know, they traded for Moses. They got another offensive lineman. They signed Tyron Smith at left tackle. They signed Mike Williams at receiver. Mike Williams, Tyron Smith, they're two really, really good players. Really good players. And Tyron Smith had a really good year. But they're on the market for a reason. And not to say that the Jets made the right decision, but it's a risk. And it's a huge risk. And with Tyron Smith, as a Cowboy fan, I know, I've had firsthand experience with it. He's very injury prone, and he's banged up. And that was the Cowboys. That, I mean, obviously he's a really good left tackle, And some may argue that the Cowboys should have re-signed him back after his really good year, but they're going to have to really be careful and be, you know, monitoring his health. Because, yes, he's a really good left tackle, but if he can't stay healthy, that deal, it's meaningless. That deal is meaningless. And the same goes for Mike Williams. The Chargers, they were in a financial bind, but it made it easy for the Chargers to make a decision because Mike Williams, he's a really good receiver. He's a great downfield threat, big body, can catch, like, really good, really good player. But he stays hurt. You can't bank on him playing 16, 17 regular season games. So I like the Jets signings, but there's some huge risk in terms of health with some of the players that they've signed. So we'll see. If both of these guys can stay healthy, that's a great sign for the Jets. All right, that's a great sign for the Jets. But history tends to show us, especially with these two guys, it's almost bound to happen that they're gonna probably miss time. Mike Williams probably isn't gonna play 16, 17 games. He's probably gonna play closer to 11, closer to 12. The same said for Tyron Smith, right? So it's always a risk when talking about these players and contracts and so forth. Okay, so I do have more questions. I'll take some time to do that some more time. You know, send in more questions. Send in more comments. I'll take the time to answer them. But I'm going to wrap it up right here. That'll be it for today's pod. Hope you guys enjoy the NCAA tournament. I'm about to do that. But without further ado, always remember two choices, one decision. And peace, deuces, I'm out.